$4 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, and People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
Hello, 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 my friends. Sorry for a little bit of confusion. I was announcing a two-hour show the whole way through. I put a whole bunch of different, things on Facebook. And there was some confusion, so there won't be a two-hour show. The story time is coming up
story
next.
Story time coming up after your last song, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So yeah, the story time is coming up after that, and to finish up the show, sorry for the confusion, my friends. I feel extremely stupid in front of all the friends who I asked to listen to, but that's life. It happens. Just a little bit of miscommunication, not a problem. So there's few cool shows happening this coming weekend, and one of the show is happening at Lana Luz, and there's Whitey, Lord Kitchener, and my friends Porn for the Blind are playing the show this coming weekend, which is happening this Friday at 8 p.m. And I'd like to play a song for by my friends Porn for the Blind. They are a local band. They have a brand new album called Medicine Cabinet, which will be out very, very soon. This is a wonderful band from North Vancouver, and this is their worldwide radio premiere of the song So High. So this is Porn for the Blind, So High. They are playing this Friday at Lana Luz. This is world radio premiere. Sorry again for the confusion. I really thought it would be a two-hour show, but it didn't happen. All good. Next time, more music. And this is amazing Porn for the Blind, local band from Vancouver, British Columbia. Have a wonderful weekend. Story time up next. Great success. Thank you. Bye.
You do, don't care what you say. I'm living it, limitless, living my way.
Yo, yo, people always in this, like mind your own damn business. I don't gotta get a witness to insist his own opinions. Like, if you wanna be so nosy, homie, show me how you really wanna sniff this shit. Why would I even bother with these stiff-lipped little kids if I'm
living my life according to me? Recording the rhythm, absorbing the beat. One time for the style, two times for the
checking, loving, loving every other millisecond of it when I'm
living my life, regretting so free. I don't got no stress problems bothering me. I fall from the sea and swim in the sky. So high, so high, so high.
People always asking me, asking unattractively, why is it I gotta rap like it was a trap? And somehow I can't get free to answer you. Cancerous, not nose, little halfway freaks. I go half a week and practically die if I can't smash a beat. Do you know what practice means? Do you know what practicing means? If you hit in half the greens I am, then you're half as keen. Cause I'm a machine, laugh, but it seems Patrick really has to fiend. A trash rappers till the caskets bleed. Double dead to you, plastic scene. Actress queens, living casting, couch mattress dreams. Never make silver screen acting scenes past your teens, that's the thing. I'm in it, longevity, plenty free. Set in the forest, serenity when I be
living my life according to me. Recording the rhythm, absorbing the beat. One time for the style, two times for the heat.
Ripping my so you can check it, love it, loving every other millisecond of it when I'm
living my life, regretting so free. I don't got no stress problems bothering me. I'm born from the sea, swim in the sky. So high, so high, so deep, oh money fly.
Thank you. So that was So High by Porn for the Blind. Sorry about the confusion, but here is story time. We are your number one source for lying people who write stories. Today we have three stories. They're all by UBC students. Our first one is going to be by Morme Zanke. The second one is by Mary Chen. And the third one, actually, we're going to have two by Aaron Chan played today. One of them, Yoshimi versus the Pink Robots, we played last week. But since I messed up the time marker, I decided why not play it again because it had cool music. And the second one, I'm actually reading live. Dun, dun, dun. It's called Showdown. So that's what we have coming up for the show today. A little bit about story time is we like to read live stories and also pre-recorded stories by you. So send me a story because I'll read it and we are hungry for stories. Before we listen to Listening to It Fall by Morme Zanke, I'd like to make a little shout out to my sister for making me get here on time because the 44 bus doesn't like to show up, and sometimes it's a nice thing to have a sister who will drive you. Thanks. So if you have any stories before we start, I would just like to say if you have any stories that you like to write, they could be real or fake. You could be real or anonymous. Send them in. Storytimeubc@gmail.com. Here is Listening to It Fall by Morme Zanke.
Before the rest of our family was awake, by opening my door and
let's try that again. Listening to It Fall by Morme Zanke.
When I was younger, my dad would take me on long road trips on a whim. He would wake me up before the rest of our family was awake by opening my door and letting the hallway light stream onto my pumpkin-patterned bedspread. He'd leave the door open like an open-ended question, and I would fumble in the dark, wondering where we were going this time. We'd drive for hours, sometimes for the whole day, and as much as I'd beg him to tell me where we were going, he would never tell. Sometimes I couldn't even tell when we arrived because the places we went were so ambiguous. One time we went to Jimmy's Palace, a pizza joint 300 kilometers away, because my dad heard it was good from his friend's cousin. We've been to lakes, amusement parks, mountains, baseball fields, movie theaters, everywhere. Every normal establishment available in our town within 30 kilometers, we went to one 10 times as far, just because we could. It wasn't until recently, 20 years later, I started to think more about why he went to so much trouble to get me out of bed on Saturday mornings. Our trips are what I remember of my father, and everywhere I go, I am reminded of the time we played miniature golf, the time we drove all day and all night to make it to the 21st annual trombone parade, the time that soccer game lasted 7 hours, and even the time I lost my pink hippopotamus sunglasses. It's all there. Every experience with him is there, every milk-mustachioed smile, every shared bag of granola, every kilometer rolled off on the odometer. I tried to explain this to my Aunt Helen over shrimp pâté hors d'oeuvres, while endless home videos of my father flashed across my Uncle Bert's ancient television set, but she didn't get it. All she said was, "It must have been nice to spend time with your father like that." Yes, of course it was, but that wasn't all it was to me, and I don't think it was all it was to him either. He took me to those places for a reason. However arbitrary it seemed, he took me because it mattered somehow. He took me because he knew this time would come when all I had was this faded, unreal picture of him, and I needed some last direction, some last human association with him, something I'd think about when the cold, metallic alarm echoed off the peeling stucco, or in the car when the rain droplets streamed lonely across the windshield. He knew me better than knowing knew itself, and because of that, I was certain those weekend retreats away meant something. I've relived every one of my childhood weekends, hoping to find some hint or reminder of what his purpose was. At first, I thought there was nothing, embarrassed with my childlike fixation on something non-existent. But then I remembered, one Saturday, late in November, after I had just turned 14, I was young enough not to think much of what he said, but old enough to understand his meaning. We were driving to Lake Madison, a lake hidden in an overgrown pine forest, forgotten after nearby farms deposited runoff and caused it to be covered in a thin layer of algae. Of course, I didn't know at the time this was our destination, but in hindsight, it all made sense that this was the place he chose to go with me on this particular hazy morning. "What is your favorite thing to do when it's raining?" I remember him asking. "Lying by the window and listening to it fall," I replied, imagining it as I said it. "Why?" "It sounds nice. It makes me feel better in some way." "Is it a happy sound?" "No, not really." "Then why do you like it?" "I just, it's hard to explain." "Try." "Okay, Dad?" "Yeah, do I have to?" "Yeah, come on, here we are on an adventure, father and daughter, driving through this melancholy forest, just give it a go. I'm sure you can explain it to me." "That's it." "What?" "Melancholy. You like the sound because it's melancholy?" "Yeah." "Would you say there's a goodness to the sadness?" "Yeah, I would say that." Then we kept driving for a while, thinking about that in the silence of the old forest and wondering when we would hear rainfall again. My father believed there could be goodness to the sadness, something that has stuck with me in life like a forgotten loonie that sits at the bottom of a pocket, unused but still valuable. Since that day, I never thought about why I liked the sound of falling rain until now. Now each time it rains, I think about that long car ride, the quiet road, and my father's steady hand on the wheel. After all these years, I'm certain this is what my dad meant. This is what he wanted me to remember without him. I realize now that each place he took me to on those early Saturday mornings were places that weren't necessarily happy, but often melancholy. They ached of loneliness, and yet I never noticed because of how happy I felt inhabiting them. I felt more alive, more aware of who I was in those moments with my father. There was goodness in the sadness. There was brilliance in our solitary travel from one forgotten place to the next. It felt as though someone had just told the both of us we only had one more day to live, and we decided to spend it together, driving towards the unknown, happy just to be going somewhere one last time. I wanted to tell him somehow that I had finally figured it out, that I had solved his riddle, understood what he was trying to teach me after all these years. So yesterday, I went to go visit him. I woke up before any of my family was awake and propped open the door of my 9-year-old daughter's bedroom. As I sat at the kitchen counter, she came to me, sleep still in her eyes and hair scrunched up with a pink hair tie. "Where are we going this time?" she asked. "Shh, you'll find out when we get there," I told her. We drove in the darkness, her little head resting on the window, her breath fogging up the glass. I thought about all the times I fell asleep with my dad at the wheel and wondered how many times he looked over at me asleep and dreaming. I woke her up as soon as we entered the forest. She liked to see the towering trees and rocks overgrown with moss. "Are we going to see Grandpa?" she asked instantly, as soon as she had peeked outside. "Yes," I said. "It's been a while, hasn't it?" She nodded sagely and kept quiet the rest of the way. I parked under the branches of a crooked pine, and we got out of the car and stepped onto the worn path. We walked for a few minutes, her small hand in mine, then the path opened up and we were there. The sun was high in the sky, and its beams slanted onto the green water, refracting as soon as it hit the surface. I thought about him, how I missed him, how I wished I could just have a conversation with the guy. I felt lonely there, at the place we had led him to rest, and then I remembered why I was there in the first place. "I figured it out," I told him. "What did you figure out?" my daughter asked. I turned to her. "I figured out that sometimes there can be goodness in the sadness. Sometimes loneliness strengthens you. It gives you courage." I squeezed her little arm to demonstrate, and she laughed, and I laughed, and our laughter echoed against the rock, and it almost for a moment felt like he was laughing with us. I looked out onto the water, acknowledging him, held my daughter in my arms, and said thank you to the guy. Thanks for making this easier.
Thank you, Mormay Zanker. What I really liked about that one was just the unhappiness that you can find, the happiness you can find in unhappiness, which is cool. I think we all kind of feel that sometimes, like, ah, oh, this sucks. But at the same time, I'm like weirdly happy that this sucks. Is that melancholy? I don't know. Anyway, that was Listening to It Fall by Mormay Zanker. She is in first year in creative writing. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Yoshimi versus the Pink Robots by Aaron Chan.
This Halloween, CITR is proud to sponsor Sussoween, taking place at Fortune Sound Club, featuring Lil Texas and Bar Lee. Plus, the Chapel Sound crew will be spinning all night alongside the Can I Live DJs. Dressed to impress in your most daring costumes, Fortune Sound Club is going to be transformed into a Halloween acid trip. Acid trip, acid trip, acid trip, acid trip, acid trip, acid trip. Be sure to pick up a limited early bird ticket being sold at Zulu, Beat Street, High Life, and Red Cat Records.
Timber Concerts presents Teen Days with special guest camp counselors, Saturday, November 9th at the Electric Owl. Tickets are available online at ticketweb.ca or at Red Cat, Zulu, and Beat Street Records. For more info, visit asylumplanet.com and timberconcerts.com.
We're back with story time. We are currently serenading you with stories. Next up is a radio drama by Aaron Chan. Aaron likes to do radio drama-esque stuff. And it's always really cool female heroes, which is I really, really like. And this one is called Yoshimi versus the Pink Robots. It also features some music by the Beatles and the Flaming Lips. So here is Yoshimi.
A beige door swings open, and in comes Timothy, age 20, last name unknown, a rather unremarkable and painfully average-looking human being. He's a graphic novelist, providing both the story and sketches. However, lately he's been experiencing a massive creative block. His blue eyes scan the room for anything out of the ordinary, specifically extraterrestrial. Alas, the only thing out of the ordinary about the room was the rug, which unfortunately did not tie the room together. He scratches his chin, the pathetic little scraggly hairs he calls a beard, straightened by his slightly stubby fingers. Closing the door behind him, he takes off his green shoulder bag and places it on the chair next to the door. Timothy proceeds briskly towards the black couch, which faced a small television set, wading through boxes of cookies, Chinese takeout, and half-finished pizza. He grabs the remote from the coffee table, which had papers and doodles on them, among other things, situated between the couch and the TV, and flipped through the channels. An audible crash is heard coming from the bathroom. The scene switches back to Timothy, who continues to flip through channels, having seemingly not heard the noise, sounds of a window closing shut and a door opening and closing. Yoshimi, a girl of Asian descent, emerges from the bathroom, donning a yellow titanium costume with an emblem of the letter Y on her chest plate. She strides effortlessly towards the couch, seemingly unencumbered by her armor, and takes a seat next to Timothy.
Out saving the world again?
Yep.
Small kitchen scene. We see Yoshimi next to a small stove, rummaging through a cupboard full of boxes of tea and bags of coffee. She takes out some Earl Grey tea and sticks the tea bag in the cup.
If you asked me a few years ago what I'd be doing for the rest of my life, catering to a self-centered, narcissistic superhero would be on the bottom of my list.
You know I can hear everything you're thinking.
In addition to being terribly invasive of one's thoughts and privacy, she is responsible for most of the mess in the apartment and pays next to nothing when it comes to rent.
If I remember correctly, Timothy, alien currency isn't worth anything on this planet. Also, if I wasn't preoccupied most of the time saving your species...
Saving the world from giant pink robots doesn't count, Yoshimi.
What do you mean it doesn't count? If it weren't for me, we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
Okay. One, having a conversation and reading my thoughts are two completely different things. And two, stop reading my mind.
Don't blame me. You're the one who supposedly created all of this.
Timothy retreats into the bathroom to be alone with his thoughts. Yoshimi shrugs, grabbing a cup from the dish rack and filling it with tap water. She looks down at the cup and lasers shoot out from her eyes, instantly heating up the water. Satisfied, she dumps the teabag into the cup. Bathroom scene. The bathroom is small and a touch claustrophobic. On the floor is an uncolored drawing of what appears to be Yoshimi. After closing the window, Timothy puts the toilet lid down and takes a seat.
Finally, alone. I never thought I'd be so happy to be alone, given that I've been complaining about it all my life. Gives me some time to think. I guess I'm pretty out of sorts these days, considering everything that's happened. I was living in relative peace until that damn girl showed up and changed everything. I know it sounds impossible, but there she is outside my room, eating all my damn food. I don't even know where she came from, or what she's doing here. No, that's not right. I do have an idea of where she came from, and what she's doing here, but...
He grabs one of the drawings from off the floor and examines it.
It's complicated. I had the most vivid dream of planets, a race of people, the Archons, capable of amazing things, and how they'd always be in conflict with these evil, yet contradictory-colored machines, bent on the destruction of everything they deemed imperfect, and, of course, Yoshimi. The only one of her people powerful enough to stop them, a woman born with extraordinary powers, who mastered the art of combat and is strikingly beautiful. I mean, come on, that's a given. She's the only one who posed a threat to the horrifically pink-colored Arlexi. She...
If you're quite done fantasizing about me, could you tell me where you're hiding those cookies, the ones with the red jelly in the middle?
Timothy sighs, leaving the comfort of the toilet and following Yoshimi out the door.
A few weeks later, after I've got this whole universe thing figured out, she comes along with her oddly colored friends. Coincidence? I don't know. Maybe I'm psychic, or maybe I'm going insane. What if this is my mind playing tricks on me? News reports saying that giant pink monsters have invaded Earth, Yoshimi's face plastered all over the internet, calling her a hero. Of all the bathroom windows she could have climbed into, she climbs into mine. Am I seeing things? The mind is capable of doing many things, like altering a person's perception of things. Is this real?
Timothy takes out a box of pink friends from the bottom cupboard and hands it to Yoshimi.
You know, for a self-proclaimed all-powerful superhero, you think you wouldn't need to plow through all my food.
Yoshimi, box of cookies in hand, heads toward the couch.
What can I say? Saving the world can really take it out of you.
I think I reserve the right to be a little selfish here. I mean, you eat all my food, you sleep in my bed, and you make a mess out of my apartment. Just what the hell do I get in return?
Yoshimi plops herself onto the couch and slides the cookies out of the box.
Humanity gets to live another day. Or were you thinking of something else?
She strikes a pose. He ignores her.
And another thing. Out of all the planets in the solar system, why did you bring your conflict here?
I don't know. You should direct that question to the Arlexi.
You mean the pink robots?
Of course I mean the pink robots. Don't tell me you forget their names already. You wrote them all down here.
Yoshimi stands up and takes one of Timothy's doodles from the coffee table, but Timothy interjects.
Put that down.
Okay, geez, no need to get angry.
She puts the drawing back on the coffee table and sits back down.
Funny, the Arlexi. Could they have chosen a less menacing color?
So, you really don't know why they've decided to wreak havoc on Earth?
Why don't you tell me? You seem to know all about us. You know what planet we're from, why we're fighting. Hell, you even got a list of all the things I can do. So why don't you tell me?
I don't know, I'm just...
Distressed, he takes a seat on the couch, rubbing his head with his fingers.
I don't know what to think anymore.
Yoshimi sighs and takes a seat next to Timothy.
Look, I know things have gotten pretty weird for you lately. Hell, I'd be pretty suspicious myself if I started seeing things that I drew come to life. But...
Yoshimi puts a hand on Timothy's shoulder.
Whatever the reason, I can assure you that this is real. Those pink robots out there trying to enslave your people are definitely real.
She places a hand on Timothy's cheek. Timothy looks up, entranced by her stare.
I'm real.
She smiles and slaps his face playfully. He is visibly annoyed.
And perhaps there is more to you than you allow yourself to believe. More than just some writer who thinks he's becoming delusional.
Timothy ponders this. Audible cries from outside the apartment building. Yoshimi turns to the bathroom, door wide open, window ajar.
Well, sounds like your people need me.
Bathroom scene. She motions towards the bathroom window, preparing to leap out. She turns around when she sees Timothy behind her.
I don't think I'll be staying long. This place is too small for me anyways.
Timothy frowns, knowing he would regret saying this.
Well, if you reconsider, after doing what you do, I wouldn't mind having you around.
Yeah?
Yeah. Just don't be such a twat about it.
What?
Nothing. Go and save the world and stuff.
Yoshimi directs her award-winning smile at Timothy, who looks away as if to protect himself from its effects. She then turns around to the open window and jumps out.
She leaps out into the night sky, leaving me to rethink my state of mind, to ponder how I fit into this world of ours. She zooms past buildings and hovers over cars filled with determination, off to do battle with a villain bent on the destruction of humanity, off to do what superheroes do best.
She's a black belt in karate. Hey! Working for the city. She has to discipline her body. 'Cause she knows that it's demanding to defeat the
Yoshimi. So that was Yoshimi versus the Fink Robots by Aaron Chan. We're going to do two little announcements, and then we're going to move on to our next story.
Buy, sell, and trade new and used vinyl records at the Main Street Record Fair. With thousands of vinyl records for sale, you can discover gems and stock up on cheap classics. Join us Saturday, November 9th and Sunday, November 10th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. for vinyl spinning DJs, food truck goodness, prizes, discounts, and great deals on tons of vinyl records. For more information, visit vinylrecordfair.com.
You're so baby. You're so baby.
Timber Concerts presents Kokorozi with special guests on Thursday, October 24th at Venue. Come support this American experimental electronic folk duo on tour to support their latest release, Tales of a Grass Widow. Tickets are available online via Ticketweb or in-store from Red Cat Records, Zulu Records, and High Life Records.
Dance by nerves in my meadow, swamp candle flower, the watery fellows, the monarchs.
I wish I was going to Kokorozi. Ah, that's tonight. Anyways, moving on in stories. Our next story is by Mary Chen. She's a first-year student. She's in creative writing, and she wants to major in creative writing. And she wrote this really nice, wonderful story. I'll let you listen to it. But just the way it kind of delves you into the life of a certain type of person, she's really talented at doing that. So here is Mary Chen, Chasing Small Fires.
At school, Lilin sticks out like the big fat yolk of a fried egg. Unlike in elementary school, almost everyone at Rosewood is white. At first, it made her nervous, but it's been a long time since then, and she's used to it now. Besides, everyone's poor, and that makes everyone the same, pretty much. So it's okay. They don't have uniforms, which her sister Mingwei says is the best part, but sometimes she wishes they did. It's still kind of embarrassing to go to school in the same shirt 3 times a week. Of course, Ming doesn't have that problem. She whines until Mama and Baba will give up and slip her a few coins just to get her out of their sight. Today, first block is math. Lilin shuffles into class with her knapsack slung over her shoulder and slides into the seat beside her best friend Crystal, who's doodling on her desk. It's a mess of squiggles and pencil strokes that makes no sense to her. Hey, Crystal says, muffled around a yawn. At the sight of it, Lilin has to stifle one, too. It had been unusually busy at the restaurant last night, and Baba had needed her to wait tables. By the time she'd gotten around to her homework, it had already been past midnight. Crystal stifles another yawn into the crook of her elbow and smiles sleepily up at Lilin. How was your weekend? Lilin shrugs, pulling out her books and pencil case as she speaks. Fine. Ty cut his lip on a plastic spoon, and both of the twins whined about it all weekend. Crystal grins, and Lilin shoots her an amused smile. Why doesn't your brother ever seem to make any trouble, hmm? He's too busy being Mr. Perfect, Crystal says, rolling her eyes. Must be so rough on you. Crystal laughs, kicks at Lilin under the table. Oh, shut up. School passes by in a blur of study, listen, stay awake. She writes down the notes on the board by rote, and during lunch, when she flips through them, it feels as if she's reading through them for the first time. She spares a minute to thank her parents for her ability to tune out and still have neat penmanship. Last block is always the longest, and Lilin can feel her eyelids droop closed even as she fights to stay awake. She's cutting red crescents into her palms with her nails, but even the pain is a dull ache, not enough to swab the cotton away from her mind. Lilin, Lilin, Crystal is whispering, jabbing a pen into her side. Lilin jolts upright, cheeks burning. Miss Williams, all 155 centimeters of her, is towering over her desk with a thin-lipped frown. Something wrong? Her teacher says simply. No, Miss Williams. Sorry, she mumbles, head down. Everyone is staring. She stays awake after that, even though the rest of the block passes by like molasses. It feels something like a miracle when the bell finally rings. Miss Williams calls out to them as they get ready to leave. Read chapter 5 of your books, ladies and gentlemen. I'll see you next class. Lilin breathes a sigh of relief as she shuffles her things together. Hey, Lilin. Crystal. Sunny and me are going to hang out downtown. Wanna come? Massa says. He has bright, glittery eyes and a chipped-toothed smile. He laughs a lot in class, is respectful to the teachers, and is bad at math. He's cute, and Lilin is pretty sure Crystal likes him. She thinks that's cute, too. He's Japanese. Lilin's mom would never be okay with that, but Crystal's a CBC, so maybe it's okay for her. Canadian-born Chinese have different rules to the landed immigrants. Sorry, I have to babysit my younger siblings. You know how it is, Lilin replies to Massa. She thinks his face falls a bit, probably at the thought of having less people to tease, but he recovers gamely. Maybe next time, he says, hands in his pockets. Lilin smiles. Maybe. She mouths, go have fun, to Crystal, who seems like she's wavering between staying staunch at her side and flitting over to Massa. After another brief pause, Crystal bites her lips and blurts out, sure. Lilin thinks she's blushing. I'll call you, Crystal whispers as they leave, and Lilin laughs as she heads down the other way. She thinks it's really, really cute. When she gets home, the house is loud and boisterous like it always is. Her little brothers, Tai and Shun, are squabbling over the plastic wrapper from the grocery store, running around the apartment like twin squalls. The banging of pots and pans from the restaurant below are mixed in with the muffled shouts of Baba to his busboys. Mama has just gotten home from teaching Chinese classes and has her feet propped up on a small stool as she knits. It's too expensive to buy new clothes, not for five kids and a husband, so Lilin has resigned herself to receiving another scratchy sweater next week. It doesn't bother her anymore. She's not stupid. It's almost winter and it's getting cold. She does wonder, briefly, if Ming will throw another tantrum like she did last year. 17 seems so far away, impossible to understand. Lilin wonders if she will be the same at that age, preoccupied with boys, makeup, perfecting her accent. Pretty clothes and the sweetest smile. She doesn't think it's worth it. All the boys she knows are either boring, mean, or her friends. Lilin, guo lai, her mother says, waving her over. Come here. Her mother holds out a tape measure, whip sharp on one end, and forces Lilin to stand still as she measures her height. Her mother makes a clicking sound in her throat, a chiding tss. You're only 14. Why are you so tall, 167 centimeters. Good God, she scolds Mandarin. Lilin refrains from rolling her eyes, only straightens her spine further. I like it. You won't when you try to find a boy taller than you to marry, her mother says, raising an eyebrow. She takes a pin out of her mouth, and as best as Lilin can tell, sticks it straight into her side. She yelps. Ugh, stay still. After she's poked and prodded to her mother's content, she's turned around to face her. The chiding falls away and Mama's face crinkles in the corners as she smiles. She rubs a thumb over Lilin's cheek. At least you're pretty, hmm? You're a good kid. Then she laughs. Smart, too, like your mother. Work has been rough on her parents lately, and it's been a while since she's seen her mother's cheeky humor. It makes something untwist in Lilin's chest. Seconds later, Tai drops something on the ground with a resounding crash. Mama startles and drops her hand, sighing. Put this away for me, Heize. She stands slowly like her joints are creaking and goes to deal with the wailing cries. After a minute, Lillian rolls up the tape measure slowly, careful not to cut herself. She looks up once to where her mother is sweeping glass off the ground, and a bone-deep sadness settles into her chest. Mama isn't smiling anymore. She just looks tired.
That was Chasing Small Fires by Mary Chen. Now maybe you know what I mean when I said, like, the way she writes makes you feel like you're in that world all of a sudden and gives you a kind of different point of view. Cool. Mary, you're only in first year. Way to be good at that. Okay, so we're going to take another quick break, and then we'll be back with the showdown, which I'm going to read live because it's a showdown. Okay, we'll be back.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, and People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
CITR presents DJing 101.9. We offer people a way to learn about the fun of mixing, sharing music, and throwing events. Our workshops and studio access is free for students and members. No experience or turntables are necessary. Workshops from 4 to 8 p.m. are on Tuesdays in 212A in the Student Union Building at UBC. For more information, visit us at citr.ca or follow at CITRDJ on Twitter.
We're back! Okay, so now we are going to be reading out The Showdown. This is a story by Aaron Chan. So here is The Showdown. Exterior, a desert, midday, a barren post-apocalyptic wasteland, dead trees, carcasses of creatures that are near extinction. The sun, the cause for these scorched lands, is unrelenting. Title card, 50 years into the future. A figure, barely recognizable in the distance, approaching closer and closer, its features becoming more and more noticeable. Grime-covered boots, thin yet firm legs, covered in a navy blue patched jeans. A long black leather coat that falls before the boots. A woman stares into the horizon with her steely brown eyes, gazing up at what's ahead. The wind rises, lifting her long, dirty white hair into the air. Though she is naturally young, the years have not been kind to her. Her skin is parched and partially covered in dried mud. Dark blemishes around her eyes. It has been a long time since she has had a good night's rest. The lower half of her face is covered with dark brown scarf, a memento from a bygone era, a part of her past that she will never let go. An abandoned-looking town up ahead, with a fence and some ashen black trees surrounding the area. Exterior, outside, midday. As she approaches the seemingly desolate town, she notices a noose hanging on one of the dead tree's branches with no body. She turns her gaze back to the town where she sees a gang of bandits walking towards the mayor's office. Exterior, inside the town, midday. Entering the town, the sounds of old wooden doors and windows closing. The people have been scared into hiding. The streets are red with pools of blood and the bodies of unlucky townsfolk. The town has seen better days. People peer out of their run-down huts as the woman saunters over to the bandit group. The bandits up ahead stand outside the mayor's office. They are of all shapes and sizes, coming from various parts of a dying world. The leader of the gang, Jackson Crawley, calls for the mayor, calling to him to coax him out of the old and decaying building. A man in his mid-30s, with a rugged appearance and clothes looted from a dead man. His wavy brown hair is slicked back, and despite the dirt on his face, he is noticeably handsome, juxtaposing his dark intentions. Exterior, outside the mayor's office, midday. The woman stands a few feet behind them and takes out a wrinkled cigarette from her coat pocket. She pulls down her scarf and puts the cigarette between her lips. She lights the match, the sound catching the attention of the bandits. Once her cigarette is lit, she drops her match onto the ground and stomps on it with her boot. Jackson Crawley smiles in recognition. There is no exchange of words between these two. Gunshots. In a fraction of a second, Crawley's crew collapse onto the ground, and their lives have been snatched right out of them. The woman is holding on to a large Smith and Wesson firmly in her hand. The smoke clears from the fire as Jackson Crawley, the sole survivor of the onslaught, finds himself staring at the woman in awe. She quickly aims at him before he has the chance to draw his weapons and fires. But nothing comes out. Nothing but an audible click. He smirks. He draws his pistol and aims at the woman. The woman seemingly accepts her fate, letting her revolver hang from her index finger. It could have ended there. But he holsters his pistol. He reaches down and grabs a Beretta from one of his dead friend's corpses and tosses it to the woman. She cautiously picks it up. Jackson Crawley is still smiling that damn smile. She holsters the Beretta. They share a moment, staring each other down. The townsfolk, hiding in their wooden huts, continue watching the couple in confusion. Jackson Crawley quickly reaches for his gun, but the woman was faster. She always was. Jackson Crawley collapses and lands face first on the ground. He groans, lifting his dirty face from the sand, clutching his chest wound with his left hand, and dragging himself to the right. He grits his teeth in pain and finally surrenders to his exhaustion. The woman strides towards him and points the gun at his head. He stares down at the barrel of the gun. Eyes well up with tears. She hesitates for a moment, but then grips her gun with renewed determination. He is put out of his misery. The woman collects what once belonged to the dead men and stuffs them into her coat pockets. Once she finishes, she turns around and begins her trek back towards the unforgiving wilderness. The townsfolk come out and watch her curiously as she makes her way out of town, never to be seen again. That was The Showdown by Aaron Chan. So that marks the end of our episode as well. It ends with a showdown, and it doesn't begin with a showdown. So today's show, I just want to go over quickly what everybody contributed. So we had Mormay's contribution, we also had Mary's contribution, and then we had two of Aaron's stories. Do you want to be like them? Send me something. Just kidding. Happily send me something. So any story. You could even send me your friend's story or your mom's story or your anonymous story. You could write a really intense, weird story and send it and be like, I don't want my name to be said. So then you're just anonymous and mysterious and your story's cool. And then you can become an online celebrity and win lots of money. Or you could just share your story. So if you do end up wanting to send in something that you did, the email is storytimeubc@gmail.com. That is storytimeubc@gmail.com. So that's our episode of Storytime. I want to thank every author who contributed, all of our talented UBC authors, because everybody was from UBC this episode. Fun. Okay. We will be moving on to our next show on CITR. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Thanks for listening.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, Temple of the Modern Girl Boutique, The Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotusland Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen, and then get riding.
Hi, we're Roused by Nature.
And you're listening to
CITR
101.9, broadcasting from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV. My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Yeah. Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down. Follow me.
Exploding Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Never change.
Hi, my name is